WBAI New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Good morning, and thanks so much for tuning in. It's 7 a.m. in New York, and coming up next is What's Going On with Bob Henley.
There's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and get here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
Good morning, New York and New Jersey, as well as the great world beyond. This is Work Bites Bob Henley at Stuck Nation, because we surely are. This is WBAI's Morning Drive Time News Magazine, What's Going On, the Labor Hour and Social Justice Edition. Michael Z. Haskins is our audio engineer, and Linda Perry is our executive producer. It's March 11, 2024. Sunrise will be at 7:13 a.m. Sunset will be at 6:59 p.m. This week, we're going to get into the mid-60s. Right now, it's 35 degrees under overcast skies. We are headed up to 50 degrees today. Tomorrow, it's a mix of sun and clouds in the mid-40s to 60s, a pattern that hangs around until Friday, when there's a 50% chance of rain with cooler temperatures. Right now, Saturday looks to be the best day of the weekend for garden cleanup. New York City's AQI, or Air Quality Index, is 23 or fair, meaning that the air quality is generally acceptable, but not for people with pre-existing conditions like asthma. We know you're out there and you're working. Be careful. This is our second get-together during Women's History Month, and Friday was International Women's Day. All month, we're focusing on the here and now for women in a country that's lost its way, rapidly rolling back women's basic fundamental reproductive rights. This morning, I'm really looking forward to my conversation with New York City Council Member Alexa Evelez, who represents District 38 that encompasses Brooklyn's western shoreline, including Sunset Park, as well as Red Hook and Greenwood Heights. Before being elected to the city council, she worked for close to 30 years in the not-for-profit realm on a broad range of social justice issues. For close to a decade, she served as the PTA president at PS 172, where she worked on empowering parents to work with the staff and students to improve the school's academic and recreational programming while advocating for increased language access. I'm going to ask the council member about why it is that in a city like New York City, a quarter of a century into the 21st century, we still see such rampant gender and race-based pay discrimination in our municipal service in essential job titles like FDNY, EMS, and probation officers. She'll catch us up on the city council's efforts to bring more transparency to the ever-changing Mayor Adams' proposed $109 billion budget, as well as on her efforts to reduce the diesel air pollution that the cruise industry generates in her district. In the B block, we're going to visit with Michelle Jackson, the executive director of New York State's Human Service Council, which is fighting to improve the pay for hundreds of thousands of social service workers who are employed by close to 170 nonprofits that help millions of New Yorkers of all ages who need some assistance to live their best life at home, in congregant care, living facilities, at school, as well as in the broader community. This workforce is made up of mostly women of color whose wages are so low, close to one in four of them have to rely on food stamps to feed their families. Yeah, that's a State of the Union, too. They'll be up in Albany today making their case to state budget makers to include a 3.2% cost of living adjustment in the state's budget for this workforce that put so much on the line during COVID. Two-thirds of this workforce struggles to get by in near poverty. And, of course, your phone calls at 212-209-2877. But first, we go to Washington for the Pacifica Network News.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The threat to democracy must be defended. My predecessor and some of you here seek to bury the truth about January 6th. I will not do that. This is the moment to speak the truth and to bury the lies. Here's the simple truth. You can't love your country only when you win.
Throughout his final State of the Union address before the election, President Joe Biden sought to differentiate himself from former President Donald Trump, who he described as threatening American democracy. Polls show the combative campaign-style speech outperforming voter expectations, but suggest it wasn't enough to move his approval ratings on key issues. Alabama Republican Senator Katie Britt's response referred to the president as a professional politician, noting Biden's been in office longer than she'd been alive. She sharply attacked Biden's border policies.
Minutes after taking office, he suspended all deportations, he halted construction of the border wall, and he announced a plan to give amnesty to millions.
Britt is drawing scorn for blaming Biden for a horrific sex trafficking incident that took place in Mexico during George W. Bush's term. She also blamed the president for migrant crime when immigrants, legal and illegal, are on average more law-abiding than native-born Americans. Another regular Republican crime talking point is also being fact-checked. Trump and others regularly portray Democratic-run cities like New York as being crime-ridden, but federal statistics show Alabama has crime rates often three times higher than those of the Big Apple. Republicans are also faulting Biden for mispronouncing the name of Lakin Riley, a Georgia nursing student murdered last month, with a Venezuelan immigrant arrested for the crime. But House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries took issue with Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene shouting criticism about the killing during the State of the Union.
These people want to lecture Joe Biden because he delivered a strong and forceful speech that made them uncomfortable because he exposed their lies and shamelessness. We have one message for extreme MAGA Republicans who want to lecture us about decorum. Get lost.
Republican National Committee Chair Rona McDaniel has stepped down and has been replaced by an ally of Trump. Michael Whatley, the North Carolina Republican Party's former chair, thanked the former president when taking the position.
I would like to thank President Trump for his trust and support. There is no one who has been more focused on fighting for the American people, and I am grateful for the opportunity to work with him to win and help revitalize our great nation.
His co-chair will be Laura Trump, the former president's daughter-in-law, who says every penny the committee raises will go to Trump's election effort. The RNC faces lackluster fundraising, compounded with the question of whether it will help pay Trump's significant legal fees. Expelled Congressman George Santos is running for Congress again. This time he's taking on the New York 1st Congressional District incumbent Nick LaLota for the Republican nomination. LaLota says he welcomes the challenge, noting Santos's record as an ineffective representative who lied outrageously and repeatedly will take center stage. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Thanks so much, Edwin. It's an honor and a privilege to welcome to our microphones Alexa Velez, councilwoman from the 38th District, as I said in the intro, that covers the western shoreline of Brooklyn. Good morning.
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Great. I just, first of all, because it is Women's History Month, I was in preparation for our interview today. I was just reading up on your biography, and there was just one line in there that sounds like it could be a whole book, the story of your own family and your mother and gun violence. If you could talk about the intersectionality of that in terms of, I mean, this involves certainly women's issues in a profound way.
Totally. Well, you know, thank you for asking about my mom. Of course, any moment I can start my day talking about my mom brings me great light. She's just an incredible woman who I lost many years ago. She was actually a substance abuse counselor, a vivacious Puerto Rican woman who turned her own life pain and experience towards helping others kind of navigate the challenges of life, right? The intersections of of poverty, of being a woman, of being a person of color, of being in a country with different customs. And, you know, she dedicated her life to that. And she was just an incredible woman, and I think inspires me every single day. And I always give her credit for anything good I ever do came directly from her teachings.
And also, though, we always think that the crises we're seeing today, like gun violence, are new. But I understand that with your father, the premature death related to gun violence, that played a role in her heroic narrative.
For sure. I mean, gun violence has been part of this country's history since its beginning. And unfortunately has not gone away and has just shape-shifted into what I think are like supremely egregious ways of being with these mass shootings. You know, I grew up in East New York, Brooklyn. You know, our family was a poor family. And unfortunately, when my father was killed, it turned our family upside down. And as many partners do, right, she had to step up and she became a single mother and had to deal with the trauma of what that meant with small children, what it meant for her life. You know, like many, unfortunately, she was able to push through that and, you know, push through the trauma and try to do the best she could, given the circumstances, much of which we're seeing so many Americans still fighting through that trauma and trying to do the best they can, given so many circumstances.
And that is the state of our union, sadly. I want to shift gears a bit to the present because one of the things that has I just always find very strange, like New York City in so many ways is considered a labor town. It's considered a blue city. Why even we know that we must be doing something right because the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, targets us with sending folks who are looking for a better life and targets and weaponizes their struggle and misery by sending them to New York City. And yet in this city, we still see, as I said in the intro, in 2024, FDNY EMS folks, primarily women, people of color, probation officers, primarily people of color. And as I in the second part of the program, we're going to talk about the nonprofit workforce who do the work like what your mom did, right, who are paid near poverty wages. I don't understand this. I don't understand that we have a city where we have an African-American mayor who himself was a police captain. We certainly Speaker Adrienne Adams, her daughter, I believe, is in FDNY EMS doing important work. Why is it we can't get this right? Why is it that we can't get pay parity and benefit parity for these people that do so much for us and lost so much during COVID?
Yeah, Bob, it's a great question. And I guess I would point to the fact that this is just a systemic issue, right? We, in many ways, we've made gains. As you've mentioned, we see, you know, the city's political leadership being people of color, and that is a great achievement. But truly, we have to go beyond that, right? The systems have baked in barriers. We also have a culture that enables that system to make sure that if we make a little progress, it course corrects in a different way. And so we're seeing very much in agencies like FDNY, right? Still very small numbers of people of color. You don't see any people of color in leadership. Although we do have a woman commissioner, you still see all of the chiefs are white males. We have a very long way to go in terms of racial and gender equity. And again, it's systemic, and there are cultural norms here at play that enable the system. And so we have to be serious about it and make very hard choices and really commit to it and unapologetically commit to correcting a system that was built for that outcome. It was built to do that. And without seriously tackling it, you know, what we're going to see is progress, but very slow progress over very long periods of time. And quite frankly, our city, our country should not be accepting of that because there's an incredible amount of talent all over New York City. And we should want to get the best opportunities for folks and set them up for success.
And one of the things, though, if I go back and look where the city council did the right thing and voted for uniform status, right, which for EFD and YMS would have lifted them up so that they could share in basic benefits for first responders, like unlimited sick, right? When we know when we put people in harm's way, a burning building, or protecting those who can't protect themselves in violent domestic settings, all very real world scenarios, we want our people to have the peace of mind for themselves and their families of unlimited sick. And EMS, of course, is limited to 13 days, and which you can run through very easily. So I guess what I'm trying to figure out here is, and then I see that the city council itself has the vision to use something like housing vouchers to uplift folks that are struggling, because you are closer to the people. And we see the mayor not following through. So it seems that even when the council does the right thing, that we have a kind of lawless system where the executive branch, and I saw this back when I was covering Bloomberg day in, day out for WNYC, where the mayoralty just is like a law unto itself. Yeah. Am I wrong?
Yeah. No, unfortunately you're not. And this is certainly our great frustration as council, really working hard to push this, like a Sisyphean task, push this boulder up a hill, and here comes the executive to deciding when he wants to follow the law and when he doesn't. And it's unacceptable. People are truly in a bad condition, right? They need support. I mean, the pay parity issue around EMS workers is just egregious, just simply egregious, that you would have an emergency worker who has to have two jobs, three jobs to make a basic living wage. And yet we expect them to put their life on the line every single day. We depend on them for the work that they do. So, you know, honestly, it makes your head spin. And we can do better. And there has to be a culture here of care and compassion first and foremost, as opposed to, you know, this is protecting certain interests. And I want everyone to always ask, whose interest is being protected?
Right. And I guess the thing is also, I get one of the things that, we just came through the State of the Union address, and of course, you're living in a universe where you have direct contact with your constituents. And so it's much more direct line of communication than between the White House and the country. And so when you heard the State of the Union address, I was wondering if you felt there was a little bit of a disconnect in the sense that what happened after, and this is my understanding of the narrative from reporting it in such granular detail through working people's experience, was that we had these social supports, the earned income child tax credit expansion for 6 months, Medicaid expansion, moratorium of foreclosure and eviction moratoriums that uplifted working families. Mm-hmm. And then it seems that Senator Manchin was just wanting to get everybody back to work. I don't know what, but with Republicans, hold the plug. And now we see, and I didn't see enough of this in the State of the Union, a hurting country where the same essential workforce, the people that are taking care of people in congregate settings, they're in a world of harm because those little supports that gave them a shot have been violently pulled away. I mean, and now we see the explosion in food stamps and the rest. I mean, is that your experience doing your constituent work?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. We are seeing that disconnect every single day. Just housing, right? Housing. We have a severe affordability crisis in New York City. Housing, just food, everything costs so much money, and stagnant wages or very, very super low wages. It's impossible. It's impossible to navigate. And, you know, we didn't see installation of these programs that are so critical and honestly that are evidence-based, right? Earned income tax credit clearly what had positive impacts over the long term. Child tax credits have clear evidence that they support people moving out of poverty, and yet, you know, the federal government is unable or uninterested in materializing these very clear supports for working people, and it's, you know, deeply disappointing. And yeah, I mean, there's a real disconnect there. We need the federal government to lean into supporting people here in the United States to be able to achieve the things they need to achieve. And they need support. They need more cancellation of student debt. They need the federal government to pour money into housing programs that will allow us to build deeply affordable housing in many of the ways, you know, in the 30s when the government really, you know, built NYCHA, when they built Milpitas-Chalama. That's what we need now. We need an infusion of capital and investment in our people and our cities. And unfortunately, that there was a glimmer of that in his address, but we need a lot more than what was presented.
Call us if you'd like to get in on this conversation, 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. Getting a little bit deeper into this question about how you work through this, this disconnect, it is also kind of like a 1-2 punch, because at the same time that the federal government, and I'll tell you, it's because the Republicans haven't decided who won the last presidential election, right? I mean, they're still fighting about that. Talk about stagnation. Yeah. One of the things about this is that the failure of the government, the federal government, to deal compassionately with the immigration crisis. And just for historical context, it's important to know, as challenging as it is, at some points in our history, in the early part of the 20th century, we had 10,000 people coming in a day. And so I think that the current hand-wringing is a little ahistorical. But that said, isn't that also part of the problem here, is that it's a 1-2 punch? It's pulling away these social supports for working-class people and then not addressing this massive unfunded mandate of being compassionate about people that we've paroled into the country that the federal government has given sanctuary to, and yet it's not really present as they morally need to be.
That's absolutely, I would say, like, it's a 1-2-4 punch. We have made an agreement, right? There is rule of law, and there is a humanitarian agreement that we have made in the international community to provide asylum. And we have not addressed the system that we need to have, a modern immigration system, in order to do this properly. And over the years, you know, it's not, the administrations have not addressed very much. And in fact, what we saw under the he who shall not be named, twice indicted president, you know, regress and actually destroy parts of a system that multiple administrations, Republican and Democrat, have spent years building. And so, you know, we're in a bad state in terms of our immigration system. And we deserve to have the best modern system that is humane, that stands up to the rule of law, that meets the international humanitarian agreements that we have made, and quite frankly, that our country purports. And it's the value, it's the values that we have brought to the international stage, and we need to step up to the plate. There's no reason for it other than disinterest. And so we can do this properly. We need to invest, and obviously it's going to take some time, but what we're seeing now is more political theater, unfortunately, that's having direct impact on people. It's making people angry. It's bringing out ugly instead of leaning into a leadership of compassion and actually addressing issues that are playing out on the ground. So,
well, actually, to also put a geopolitical lens through it, I have found that if you want people to stay where they're living, you stop bombing their countries. I don't know about you, but I'm a practical kind of guy.
Yeah, you stop meddling in people's economics, destabilizing their economies and sending bombs over. Yeah, that would be a great start for sure.
Because usually they like to stay where they've been with their family for generations.
Without question. People are not coming here because they're suddenly like, hey, this would be a fun thing to do to totally improve my life.
I'll catch a Viking cruise over
myself
there.
At risk.
Right. And so I also just wanted, in the remaining time, there's a couple, you're doing so much. So I want to try to cover it all. I popped in on one of your oversight hearings, trying to track down. We all know that we do have in certain sectors a need for workers, and we have people that are coming to the country who need work. And so one of the key things there is consensus on is the need to accelerate the ability of folks to get paperwork to start working, regardless of their immigration status. you're trying to pin the mayor down, and it's like, it reminds me of trying to nail cranberry jelly to the wall as to what exactly they're doing in terms of their expenditures when it comes to this business of making that connection for work for migrants. What are you finding, and what do we need to do better?
Yeah, I think a whack-a-mole or pinning jelly is definitely a good metaphor for what it feels like, what the findings are. In some ways, you know, we're investing to be responsive and then doing, you know, instituting policies and practices that directly undermine that investment. So, for instance, with this 30-60-day rule where people are being evicted from shelter. So you put them through an asylum process to get their work authorization, which takes time to get the paperwork. You need to be contacted. Immigration is very complex and very time sensitive. If those papers get lost or you never, you know, you can't respond to the appointments that you require, you lose it. It's wow. Over. And this is a deeply problematic situation where we hear on the ground people are not able to access the things that we have tried to get them, like IDNYC or like, you know, their work authorization, their correspondence. So, you know, these policies undermine one another. And, you know, we need to have a sensible, cohesive policy that will, like, continue to move people along a journey as opposed to setting all these trap doors. Every time you turn around, it's another trap door. And how do you get out of these situations? So it's a really frustrating affair. I mean, there are positives, but there's also a lot of places that we need to simply do better. We need to hold a higher standard of care and practice with people regardless. And the same standard that we hold for, you know, New Yorkers who have been here for decades, U.S. born folks, we're going to hold the same standard of practice for foreign born folks, new arrivals, because that's what we should be striving for.
Well, and that sounds like in the last couple of minutes that we have, I've been doing a lot of reporting over decades about the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, particularly the impacts of the global freight operation they run in Ironbound, which has had such devastating health consequences for the communities of color in and around the port complex with diesel fumes, particularly on young people and on the elderly. You've had some breakthrough. Talk to us about what you're doing with the cruise industry and the move the city council is going to be making soon. Or you already did.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you for all that work. It's so important. So we just passed a bill that will mandate shore power for use by cruise industries who berth at New York City. Now, our two ports, one in Brooklyn and my district, semi-functional. Manhattan needs to get built, but this is really going to mandate that our city urgently move towards full investment and 100% functional shore power. Folks don't know that an idling cruise ship is equivalent to 34,000 tractor trailers idling.
Wow.
And, you know, you don't just have to live right next to the cruise terminal to have the impact of that, right? And you think of all the years of the ships sitting at port idling, deeply, deeply polluting. I mean, these emissions are, quite frankly, just terrible for all New Yorkers. So, you know, we're pushing the city to lean into decarbonization at every measure. I mean, we should be doing this. This is very much a no-brainer. In addition to addressing the trucks and all the work that you have done over the years, we must do better. We do not have a choice in this matter unless we are saying we're giving up on our people and our planet, and that is not an option.
Well, one of the things is that in California, where they did require new diesel trucks, which is good for the economy, there was a marketed improvement in the respiratory health of the people that live near it. It is such a crime against humanity to ignore these. It's just crazy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, we can do this. This is, you know, other parts of the country, other parts around the world, truly leaning into decarbonizing, switching out the trucks, doing electrification. You know, there's no reason for this. This endangers all the citizens, the workers, everyone. I mean, we don't get a second shot at our air. So I think really excited about the legislation and so much work to be done.
How can people get in touch with you and all you're doing?
Oh, for sure. So you can find this on the City Council website, NewYorkCityCouncil.gov, and you can look on the District 38, Alexa Viles. Our district office is here in Sunset Park. You can find us on social media, District 38, New York City. Love to hear from you.
All right, thank you so much. And we look forward to speaking with you soon. We'll see you at City Hall.
Well, I'll see you then.
Right, that's Council Member Alexa Aviles, District 38. We'll be right back after this from Tracy Trattman.
Talking about a revolution that sounds like a whisper. Don't you know? Talking about a revolution that sounds
like a whisper.
While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know? They're talking about a revolution. It sounds
like a whisper.
Poor people gonna rise up and get their share. Poor people gonna rise up and take what's theirs. Don't you know you better run?
Turning tables. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio in New York and New Jersey, streaming live online at WBAI.org. All of these Labor Hour shows are curated online at WorkBytes, thanks to Debbie Daughtry and Joe Maniscalco. This week, we're going to get into the mid-60s. Right now, it's 35 degrees under overcast skies. We're headed up to the 50-degree mark today. Tomorrow, it's a mix of sun and clouds in the mid-40s to 60s, a pattern that hangs around mercifully until Friday, when there's a 50% chance of rain with cooler temperatures. Right now, Saturday looks to be the best day of the weekend for garden cleanup. New York City's AQI, or Air Quality Index, is 23 or fair, meaning that the air quality is generally acceptable, but not for people with pre-existing conditions like asthma. And we know you're out there working, serving us, so be careful. This week's What's Going On, the Labor Edition, is supported with a sustaining contribution from 32BJ SEIU, America's largest building service union, representing more than 175,000 workers in 11 states and Washington, D.C. Organizing is 32BJ's lifeblood. Its strength comes from growing the collective. Its members say, when we fight, we win. So it is... it's great now to have a chance to speak with Michelle Jackson, director of the Human Services Council, who's going to be up in Albany later today, doing such important work on behalf of the hundreds of thousands of nonprofit sector workers that really make it possible for millions of New Yorkers to live their best life. Good morning, Michelle.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
So, I just want to try to get a picture of this first, because it is something that goes unseen. It's kind of like a theme of her story, history, right? The work of women making the world work. It's kind of like I refer to it as the large, lazy Susan in the sky. We don't know how it happens, but every day, people that need help getting assistance to put their clothes on, people that need just a little bit of human compassion and physical assistance to have independent living, they rely on the people that you're advocating for. Give us a sense of who is this workforce?
Well, you're absolutely right. This is still very much women's work, although we don't, that term doesn't always have the best connotation. The sector, human services workers across New York State are overwhelmingly women. About 80% are women. And similarly, about 80% are people of color. with 57% being women of color. So that's who are in these jobs. And these jobs really vary from childcare workers and after school programs. So all the ways in which children get additional support outside of school hours and parents get support so that they can go to work. It's senior centers and assisted senior living. It's home delivered meals. So all the ways in which people can trust that their aging relatives have extra support. And then it's also supporting those who are experiencing homelessness, eviction prevention, substance abuse, working with people with developmental disabilities. It's a really broad range of types of jobs. And like you said, I think a lot of people in their lives are touched by nonprofit human services, whether that's playing community basketball on the weekend or, you know, during COVID, a lot more people were in need of mental health services and also food right. delivery and food access. So it really runs the gamut.
So one of the things about this that I find in some ways it has potential to make for some transformative social change, but it's depressing in the here and now. All the reason why you're going to Albany is that taxpayers all over New York State and the businesses that pay taxes are also funding these contracts, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in essence, what we're doing here is promoting a kind of plantation system where people that are doing the most essential work are forced to live in very marginal situations. Looking at some of the details you guys put out, something like 22% rely on food stamps, 2/3 are living near poverty. Am I getting that wrong? Is that data right?
Yeah, unfortunately, that data is correct, and you aren't wrong. The human services sector across the state of New York and in the counties as well is predominantly funded by government. Government has really turned over a lot of these services to nonprofits, and we think that's right because nonprofits combine private fundraising and philanthropy and various government contracts and can work, you know, in partnership with government but also access resources that government cannot. And so, but unfortunately, government has taken advantage of that system to slowly divest from the nonprofit human services sector and leaving nonprofits in this impossible choice where they either take a contract that doesn't pay enough and try to fundraise to fill the gap, or they turn down those contracts and a community loses the service and a lot of people are laid off. So unfortunately, nonprofits are really stuck in this cycle of trying to get government to pay their fair share. And it really centers around wages, which is why we're up in Albany.
Right. Cole, are you someone that works in this sector? Are you someone whose life is empowered and improved by one of these workers? 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. So let's get down to details. You're looking this year for 3.2% cost of living adjustment, right?
Yes, we are asking for that. The governor put 1.5% in her executive budget, so we're looking for both her and the legislature to come together to fund the full 3.2% COLA. The last 2 years, we were able to get COLAs, which we're very thankful to the governor and legislature for putting in, and it actually reverses about 15 years prior. There was no across-the-board human services COLA. So while the governor and the legislature have really started to reverse that, we have a lot of ground to make up for. So we're here looking for a COLA this year, and we're also looking to implement legislation to dive into the real underfunding of human services wages, because if you're at the poverty line, 3.2% COLA doesn't get you there. But we have to start somewhere, and the COLA is absolutely essential, but we really need to look at ways to ensure that the government isn't paying these poverty wages to nonprofits anymore.
So, and I guess you guys, you were involved with, I thought was a very creative effort last budget cycle on the municipal front down in New York City, where folks who are in leadership positions in these nonprofits doing such important work did an overnight vigil in City Hall Park. Were you in that mix?
Yes, that was us. That is my fault. The Just Pay campaign is working at both the
great event
state level. Oh, thank you. Yeah, the Just Pay campaign is really at the city and state. And, you know, I think what we were trying to demonstrate with that action was nonprofit executives are up all night. They're losing sleep because they're really in this position and they're fed up. And so, you know, we stayed outside of City Hall all night. It's the only day it rained in June. It's cold to stay in June. And, you know, really to demonstrate their commitment to their workforce. You know, this is not like other industries where...
Hey, if you do it again, you know, I'll come.
Oh, great. Well, I would love to not have to do it again, but trust me, if we have to, we will.
Right, right. So I understand we have a call on the line. Caller, where are you calling from? What's on your mind and what's your name?
Yes. Good morning. My name is Maria Lizardo. I'm the executive director at NMEC, and we have been actively involved with Just Pay. Thank you so much.
What does NMEC stand for? Give us that. What does that acronym stand for?
Sure. It's Northern Manhattan Improvement Corporation, and we're a settlement house serving Upper Manhattan and the Bronx, about 14,000 community members a year.
Wow. Okay, go ahead.
So my question to Michelle is, many folks in New York City and New York State have benefited from the human services sector, whether it is that they work there or they have received services there. So how do we get the general public to care about our workers who pour their hearts and soul into this work day in and day out?
All right. Please call again. That was very succinct.
Well, Maria is definitely, by the way, leading a lot of our efforts. She was with us in the Sleep Out last year, as well as emceeing our rallies. And I think this, first of all, really grateful to be on the show today, because I think this is how we convey this message to the general public, by getting out there in the press. And I think our presence at City Hall and in Albany, you know, we first have to convince legislators and the governor, who I think a lot of, you know, a lot of their constituents use human services. And so being up here today with over 200 people to really make our case in Albany is absolutely critical. And then I think nonprofits have to make space, like Maria Lizardo has at NMEG, for advocacy and to engage in the broader community. NMEG does incredible work. They're, you know, doing work with legal services and eviction prevention, which obviously after COVID was, you know, even more crucial. And, you know, groups like that really need their time to shine. And the only way to do that is to make space to, like, really tell your stories. And that's on social media, you know, at local events, and really being engaged with elected officials as well as your community, which I know Maria is.
So one of the things is, we are part of our remit here is to talk about the labor movement. And I know in some cases that there has been union representation, and it's what is your relationship with labor? I also understand that these groups have very fragile finances, and so part of this whole thing is the need to stabilize this entire sector. You do have some union representation in the mix, and are unions helping you uplift these workers?
So we definitely have union representation. About a third of my members, we have about 170 members, are unionized. Another third have some union involvement, right? So some of their workers can be unionized. And then we have organizations that are fully unionized. And we've seen, especially, you know, like in the home care movement, home care workers definitely work very closely with their union to lift wages. And we at the local level in New York City work very closely with DC 37, who has been supportive of our efforts and the Just Pay campaign. And like you mentioned, really, it's different with the union negotiations in the nonprofit sector, because they're not just negotiating with management. They have to negotiate with government. So a union can come to a nonprofit and say, you know, we want X, Y, and Z. It will cost $2 million. The nonprofit leaders can say, sure. But if you're 90% government funded, government has to increase the value of those contracts. And a lot of times that's not what's happening.
That's just like the struggle that I covered at City and State with 1199 SEIU with hospital workers, right? So and they were able to work with, like, Presbyterian and other hospitals did go back into the contract, give them a raise. But then, like you say, because Medicaid is the way that New York State funds healthcare for about 40% of the population, particularly folks who have economic issues. And so you're right, there needs to be that conversation. It's not just enough to get management to sign on, but you have to get the buy-in of the government.
Exactly. And so it's really a triangular negotiation. And then in the meantime, you know, a lot of the sector is not unionized. And that's where we come in, is making sure that workers who are not unionized are able to get, you know, those benefits, and working with our union partners to lift up everybody's wages together.
Right. So we have another call. You're popular. We have another caller on the line. Where you're calling from? What's your name?
Good morning. My name is Greg Morris. I'm the CEO of the New York City Employment and Training Coalition. We're an organization that works with workforce development providers across New York City, 220 in total, all focused on job readiness, training, and supports for New Yorkers seeking access to meaningful career opportunities. And I was one of those CEOs outside of City Hall with Michelle and folks pushing for the cost of living adjustment.
In the rain.
Attention to the human service sector. In the rain. I had to pick the rainiest day, of course, but up all night doing that. And I guess that what I wanted to communicate here is our organizations are focused on job readiness and training and opportunities, both for new New Yorkers, focused on New Yorkers from underserved, under-resourced communities, focused on also reskilling and upskilling, because now, you know, with new industry, new opportunities available, folks need access to jobs that are going to have connection to economic opportunity for the long term. That's both in outside the labor structure and inside the labor structure, both. As far as Michelle goes, she's a champion of this work. And I'm just wondering if maybe she could talk about how it is that she's thinking about developing career ladders so that this workforce can get those COLAs. We can see a wage floor increase over time, but we can also see folks get jobs and grow within the sector, because we know there, Black and brown New Yorkers in particular, struggle oftentimes to find their way into jobs that have economic security.
That's a great question. Michelle?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I'll definitely be, you know, Greg is helping me answer it with his work at the NYCETC. And I think first, Greg really points out an important perspective about this work is that these are really important community jobs. These are not jobs that are going to be outsourced, right? Like home-delivered meal and home care, youth services, child care, senior services, these are all going to stay in communities. And they're overwhelmingly held by people of color. And if we want to think about, you know, equity and how to lift up people in those communities, these are jobs that could be great career ladders. But if you start those jobs and you're making $35,000 or $40,000, you leave the industry and you don't come back. And so having higher wages for the base salaries, you know, one of the things we're part of the minimum wage campaign to get the minimum wage up. We're looking at wage floors and true cost of living. You know, how can we make sure that people, when they enter the sector, feel valued and stay so that they can rise up to positions and become executive directors of the organizations they work at and dedicate their lives, which is what we typically see in the sector, and we're seeing less of it. So I think a career ladder, an important perspective of that, is having well-paying jobs where people feel valued and respected. And that's part of the wage board legislation that we're passing, we're hoping to pass this year with sponsors, Senator Ramos and Assemblymember Bronson, to really look at how the state is crafting these contracts so that there is better parity. You know, government jobs pay about 30% more than nonprofit jobs for the same work. So the career ladder for nonprofits is get a job in a nonprofit, show your value, go work in government. Right?
So, I wanted to go back because I was hearing something that I think we need to expand a bit on. The Human Services Employee Wage Board, it went by quickly. Break that down a bit. Let's pause a bit and talk about that concept so people get a sense of what it's about.
Absolutely. So wage boards have been used in various ways at the state of New York. Typically, they are kind of a union model, but we've also used wage boards to look at like nail salons, health and safety standards. Ramos did an incredible job with that, and farm workers and other issues. And
right.
What we're asking for is to create a human services wage board to really open the books at state agencies and say, when you're crafting these contracts, because what they do is they say they really set rates, the state does, on contracts, and they estimate, you know, what a unit of service costs, right? Like what is per child daycare or at a senior center, what is each meal going to cost? And they, by doing that, they also estimate what wages should be in those areas. And we've seen contracts coming out of the state where they think a social worker should make $40,000 or $45,000. That's a master's level position. So the wage board would help us examine what are the policies of state agencies, how could we look at a wage and benefit scale and ensure that those state contracts are paying. We could also do
benchmarking. Oh, that's a great idea.
Yes, absolutely. So really, you know, we could also do it through legislation, but as we know, legislation, it's hard to, you know, they have to get funded in the budget every year. It's very hard to fund legislation. Legislation that kind of mandates things is great, but when it comes to the state having to pay for it, it's very difficult. So this wage board would be a great way for us to examine what are all of the mechanisms that we can use to ensure that when government contracts with nonprofits, they're doing so in a way that promotes a better economy and better jobs.
Well, and so one of the things, though, as you probably know, we are having a major problem across the country, really, in civil service and public sector employment. COVID really had a tremendous impact. There was a death toll, which still hasn't been fully explored. We know we lost 3,600 mm-hmm. health professionals in the first wave, close to 700 in New York and New Jersey, close to 500 in New York alone. We know that people that in New York City, close to 500 folks in different civil service titles, people who would do work like chauffeuring around homeless folks, unsheltered people, people that were doing the kind of work you're describing in the nonprofit sector, they were doing in the public municipal function. Wasn't this also the benefit of you could be training up folks who are doing this and they might consider an appropriate civil service title? It doesn't say, I mean, you're about building the workforce. Isn't there some application? It wouldn't be in the interest of both municipal and county and state employers to say, hey, gosh, we got people who have the willingness to serve some vocation. Let's uplift them. I mean, couldn't that be a valid career choice after they've come through the process? I bet it happens in the real world.
Oh, absolutely. I think we really want people from the nonprofit sector to go into government. And we want people from government to leave their careers when they're ready and come to the nonprofit sector, because we need partners in government who understand these programs. You know, the state agency staff who have worked in these programs are much more capable, right, of understanding the nuances of these programs. So we don't mind being a career ladder for government. We would just like it to go both ways and make sure that people are leaving because they're ready for the next stage of their career. But you're totally right. This is a great training ground. You get a lot of experience in working with constituents and really tackling hard, you know, challenges. And having those partners in government who have worked in nonprofits, they have been really some of our most valuable partners.
Yeah, you know, Michelle, you've actually educated me today and got my thinking informed in a way that before I started, I didn't. I always had seen, quite frankly, because I've done a fair number of stories about nonprofits that run amok, right? And we know about it. We've got to be honest. There are cases of waste, fraud, and abuse. Often it's because they are in this situation where I can, it's almost like an archetype. They have a great idea. They've got community support. The city or state or county is slow in paying them. It can come off the rails because then they stop paying the federal withholding, right? That's one thing. Then you do have, you know, folks that see it as a criminal enterprise. It's a very small percentage, but it makes headlines. I'm now seeing it more as a complementary thing of how we can work together, the civil service and the nonprofit sector, to make for a truly caring economy.
You're absolutely right. You know, just like in every industry, there are bad actors or people that, you know, just businesses shut down or people don't act appropriately. And unfortunately, the nonprofit sector, we're not, you know, immune from that, but I have hundreds of members and you never hear about them because they're just doing good work every day that doesn't make the news. And you're right, it's only that small percentage that does make the news when something goes wrong. And you're also right that a lot of the times when something goes wrong, it's because the agencies have been really stripped of resources and are struggling. And you're right, they're very complementary to the civil service workforce. We need each other, we need to lean on each other in order to make New York better for everyone.
So how can we get in touch with you and how can we lend you support up in Albany? Would it be great, say, if a whole bunch of retired civil servants wrote their legislator? Like, help me out here. What's an activity for today?
Absolutely. We would love to. You're welcome. Everyone's welcome to go to justpayny.org. You can sign up to get our emails where we have lots of actions and you can also see very clearly what our asks are, a 3.2% COLA and a wage board. And we would love for people to call. You know, we're hearing the one houses are in the works right now. Love to have you call your local legislator and the governor and tell them that you support human services workers.
Thank you so much. Well, I'm going to have you on again as we get closer to crunch time. And again, keep me on that speed dial in the event you all want to hang out overnight at City Hall.
Absolutely. We'll think of something fun for you to do. Thanks so much.
All right. We always need an activity. That's Michelle Jackson. From the Human Services Council. It's all for us. It's Democracy Now! Is up next. And remember, you get the world you fight for nonviolently. We bring more than a pay.
paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. More than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families.
I wanted more. Pay, but what I've got here today is more than I bought. Woman born the year I got the vote, who sang with a nightingale in every note.
You're tuned to listener sponsor WBAI in New York with a moment in women's history.
I was recently at the University of Delaware making a speech, and I was greeted by I'd say more vigorous pickets than those outside. With the, they had white helmets and swastika signs on. And the signs that were held up said, "Abort Bella."
Activist, politician, and feminist icon Bella Abzug speaking out for the right to abortion on March 10, 1973. She said abortion is a fundamental and a human basic right.
We have the right of speech. I may sometimes make a speech that somebody doesn't like. They can't stop me. They just have to walk away and not listen. It's the same thing with the right to abortion. There's who have a right to abortion, have a right to exercise that right. There are some who, as a matter of conscience or religion or whatever reason, disagree that there should be an abortion. Fine, they do not have to have an abortion. That's one thing that the Supreme Court does not decide. Rights are only rights if you exercise them. If you don't want that right, then you don't have it. That's all there is to it. But you can't interfere with the right of somebody else to exercise that right.
Bella Abzug, known as Battling Bella, was a Bronx native, a civil rights and labor lawyer who served in the House for three terms in the 70s. She was known for her confrontational style and radical politics, and as a champion for women's rights and the environment.
I'm very happy to express my own solidarity with women in this auditorium, in this country, as well as all over the world, who are struggling to demand basic rights, not only over their own bodies, but indeed over their own destiny in every aspect of social life.
You can receive our Women's History audio collection with Bella Abzug and other trailblazers by becoming a WBAI buddy, a sustaining member for $15 a month. You'll also receive our fabulous tote bag. Please go to women.wbai.org, again, women.wbai.org, to become a buddy in the name of your favorite program or in the name of all WBAI programs. Or call 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950 and say yes. I want to become a WBAI buddy this Women's History Month.
Next time the legends tell it.
For the better part of a century, Hour of the Wolf has given WBAI listeners the opportunity to listen to many of the great classic voices of science fiction and fantasy literary luminaries, ranging from Octavia Butler.
I had God charge Martha with creating a better human species.
To Frank Herbert,
Kabbalah is a person who can be many places at once.
From Ken Liu to Ursula K. Le Guin.
Physiologically, for 25, 26 days a month, they are no gender. They are ungendered beings. And then they go into heat.
We also bring you many of the up-and-coming creators in the field, as well as genre movie reviews. In the past, you had to visit Morning Twilight or Witching Hours to hear the show, but now you can find host Jim Freund with new guests and classic recordings as part of WBAI's Art Strip, Monday nights at 9 p.m. Join us.